Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Okay, so, all right, I'm recording. So, hello, everybody. Welcome to the Life Autistic Podcast, episode whatever it is. It's Saturday, May 8th, 2021. With me, as always, is super producer, Dr. Drew.
I'll take that.
Skittles. That's
no, your new Skittles. I want Dr. Drew.
Dude, no, your new nickname could be Skittles.
Don't change that.
That's dope. I'm going to call you Skittles from now on.
Oh, please don't. Our friendship will take a terrible twist.
What's that? Yeah, you're all like, Dr. Drew. And then I'm like, Skittles. Oh. And with us today is Dave from California, USA. Where are you? I know you just told me before, but where you want to tell our listeners where you're from again?
I'm in San Diego County, California. I'm in a small semi-rural town called Fallbrook, which is in North San Diego County. About 45 minutes north of the city of San Diego.
Okay, cool.
I just say I'm in San Diego and let people figure it out.
So we will just say San Diego.
Yeah.
On our notes.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I live in Southwestern Ontario in Canada, like in a small town. But if people like from other parts of the world, like where are you from? I just say Toronto. Cause you know,
yeah,
it's like, you know, it is what it is.
Dave, I'm in Rockwood, Ontario. My dog's barking. I'll be right back. I'm going to go bring her inside. She's terrorizing the neighborhood.
Cool. Nice tie dye, bro.
Thanks,
Dave. So how did we first get in touch? Do you remember? Did you hear the show or did we discover you somehow?
Well, I heard the show. I had been wanted to hear some more autistic adult voices and autistic adult perspectives. And I had listened to other podcasts and they had autistics on it, and I'm like, wait a minute, let me search this avenue and see what is there.
Yeah.
And I searched the internet. I saw your podcast and I saw the description. I'm like, this seems kind of, I'll check this out, a whirl, see what it is. And I listened to a couple episodes and I'm like, right on, this dude was late autistic like myself.
Yeah.
And I was jiving with what you were saying and your message and
cool
everything. And I was like, this is cool. And I'm like, I feel like I've got a message. I got something I want to say. I feel like I have a perspective that's unique just as anyone else's. And I reached out and just like, hey, this is this is who I am. Yeah. I heard your show, like it. A little bit about me, you know, maybe we could collaborate or something. Yeah. And one thing led to another, and here we are.
Cool. Can I ask how old you are?
I am 45.
45. We are the same age.
Come on.
We are.
But you still have hair. Hey. You're so lucky.
Yeah. I'm happy because I know because most of the men in my family don't have hair.
Oh, right?
I don't rub it in their face. I'm just like, well, I have hair.
I was basically by the time I was 30, I had to just shave my head. It was gone. Or thin enough that I couldn't have hair, you know. But yeah.
Yeah, mine's graying, but I don't care because I'm like, I'd rather have gray hair than no hair.
Yeah, same. If I would have been given the choice, I would have been like, I can go all gray, I don't care. But I do. I mean, you know, hey, it is what it is. I accept things in life. You can't change. Exactly. But if I were able to have that choice, I would have like long flowing locks. But you know, there.
I actually had a barber one time tell me that my hair was so thick that like they had a hard time cutting with their normal scissors and shears.
Oh, nice.
There's like, your hair's really thick. And I'm like, well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm like, oh, it's a great thing. If it's thick into your adulthood, more than likely it's going to be thick throughout most of your adulthood. Yeah. And it won't start thinning till you get older. And I'm like, cool.
Nice. I remember so like
somebody calls you thick headed. It's just like, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I remember
yeah,
like,
when, and?
Yeah, great.
I remember like people, you know, like people would always say like, you look to your mother's
father
for your hair. And when I was a kid, like my granddad had a full head of hair right up until he died at like 90. So I was just like, yeah. But then I was like 25 and it was like coming out. And I was like, shit. But anyway, so that's our hair segment on the show. So we like
heredity.
What's that?
Can't trust genetics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. Well, I'm glad you reached out, man. And like, and that's exactly what the purpose of the show is. Cause that's like when I was in this similar boat when I first started down my path of discovery of my own at that time undiagnosed autism, and you know, in general, and just finding that there was a big gap in the you know information available and stories. I'm a story person. I love stories. I love hearing about people's stories. I want to know like what things are like for people. And I just went, oh, there's not. When I went through this process, like I got my official diagnosis last year at 44, but I kind of self-diagnosed a year or two before that after years of suspecting. And I just thought, God, there's gotta be more people out there like me who are in their, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever, who are just like gone through life and always kind of had this sort of itch in their mind of like, why do I feel different? Like, what is going on? Why are certain things harder for me that are easy for most people, and other things are easy for me that are hard for most people? And why is communication difficult? And why are certain environments difficult? And so I wanted to do that. So I'm glad that you discovered the show, and I'm super happy you reached out and you're here. And now I'll try to shut up so you can talk.
Well, I just like, well, one of the things that I think the catalyst that led me to my autism journey is I have a son that's 15 and a half now, and he was diagnosed autistic when he was younger, as a toddler. And also my spouse is autistic, and she didn't discover she was autistic until her adulthood either.
No way.
But that's, and I use the term spouse because that's how we define our relationship.
Yeah.
Each other's spouses. Yeah. That's how I'll leave it at that.
Sure.
And when my son got diagnosed, you know, just like any parent at that time, I was like, you know, all you hear is this fear mongering and all this like, oh God, it's catastrophizing. It's going to be the worst. It's going to be, their life is going to be torture. It's going to be hell. It's going to be.
Yeah. Fear.
It's going to be really difficult. And, you know, we were sold that narrative. So to a degree, we bought that narrative until we realized, wait a minute, we're the kind of people that always like, if you always focus on what you can't do, you never avail yourself to what you can. And it's like, I'm not going to do that for my son. I'm not going to focus on what he can't do. And then we were doing a certain kind of therapy. I don't know if I can bash therapy on here or not, but
you can say whatever you want, man. We have no judgment about anything.
We were doing ABA. Yeah. We were told ABA therapy to start out with, which is, it may work for some. It didn't work for us.
Yeah.
From our experience, it doesn't work for most. It's manipulative. It's abusive. It's not as helpful as people espouse it to be. And we realize we don't want this. We want something different. And through our son's diagnosis, we realized we were autistic. We were like, hey, behaviors that he's showing and he's displaying are similar to things that we displayed and such when we were younger.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we grew up in the 70s and the late 70s, mostly in the 80s and 90s. That's when our developing years, you know, where autism wasn't the thing that it is now.
Yes.
And it wasn't as widely diagnosed and prevalent. And, you know, the terrible stigma was all around it. And we realized this isn't right. We want something different. So we abandoned that and we took a little hiatus and we shortly discovered this therapy called relationship development intervention.
Okay.
Which focuses more on the family dynamic and creating social relationships and harmony between each member of the family and between the family unit as a whole. Okay. And it I would say it was transformative. It just puts you in your natural element, and you just, part of our requirements at the time were just to, if we can, just try to briefly record interactions and things that we were doing, and then we would give it to our trained therapist who would look at it and evaluate and talk about the social relationship. Like, the way you communicate in this area was awesome.
Yeah.
Perhaps try doing this next time, or try using this strategy or, you know, and it was just really focusing on the social and the family dynamic. And it was transformative for not only him, but for us as well. And it really made our family more cohesive and better, because with ABA, my son was becoming more prompt, compliant, and just like asking for permission to do things that nobody should have to ask permission to do. It's like, can I go use the restroom? Well, yeah. You don't have to go. This isn't school. It's not prison or whatever. You know, you could, if you got to pee, go pee, you know, or like asking if I can have a snack? I'm like, yeah, you know, if it's within reason, you know. No, not like if, oh, we're going to eat dinner in 5 minutes. So it's probably not a good choice. But yeah, if you want a snack, go get a snack. And we just thought that system of punishment rewards was just no bueno for us.
Yeah.
And we discovered the RDI that I mentioned, and it's been great.
Yeah.
And we don't do it formally anymore, but we continue to meet with a family therapist every other week, that where we discuss what's going on in our family, our dynamics, and how we interact and how we get along. And that's where we are right now. Yeah. And I gotta give a shout out and a plug. They sponsor this conference.
What?
They had this conference in the past.
Okay.
It was called Love and Autism. That they haven't had it in a number of, in the last couple of years. Not just because of the pandemic, but for other factors and reasons. But I got to give a plug out to this conference. It was just awesome. They had autistic adults that embraced who they were and spreading a positive message that it's just a different diversity. It's just a different way of thinking, different way of interacting, a different way of perceiving, just a different way of being. And that we're worthy of acceptance and inclusion and being a part of society and the norm, just like anybody else. Our norm is just different and it's not bad or anything. It's just different. And they had a lot of, in the several years that they had the conference, they invited several well-known autistics. They've had John Elder Robison. I don't know if you know him.
I don't think so.
He's pretty famous. He wrote a book with a cubby in the title. I can't remember the exact name of it.
What's his name again?
John Elder Robison, R-O-B-I-S-O-N. He's actually, I think he used to work with the band Kiss. He used to like make guitars or something for them. And
I have his book. I haven't read it yet, but I do have that. Look Me in the Eye, it's called. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was there. And then they've had, one year they had Barry Brezant. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a famous autistic researcher. He was actually doing autism research back in the 80s and such, when autism was still stigmatized and, you know, they were telling autistics they have to be institutionalized or they can't be part of the mainstream or the norm. And he's an academic, but he's an autistics academic, if you will. He listens to our voices, not their voices.
Yeah. What's his name? Barry
Prezant. Prizant.
Oh, okay.
And I've actually been on his podcast.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, I did a little segment for his, which was awesome. And he does that podcast with a guy named David Finch.
Okay.
Who is, he's a husband that wrote a book about being an autistic father and how, after he got his autism diagnosis, how it changed his relationship with his spouse and how he became a better father. And
because
he realized, hey, I'm not trying to be difficult. My brain works different. I just interact differently. But, you know, they had different great speakers like that. They've had so many, I'm going to plug out all these names. These are people that I trust. They have Anita Lesko, who is an autistic female. They've had, Amy Sequenzia, a non-speaking autistic. And these are, I want to give a shout out as much as I can to autistic females, or autistics that present themselves as female.
Yeah.
Because in my opinion, they don't get the attention and they don't get the respect that they deserve.
Yeah.
Because we all know that autism is more diagnosed in boys than it is in girls. And there's just as many female autistics as there are male autistics, in my opinion.
Yeah.
They just don't get the attention in the same as others. And I try to use more gender neutral pronouns because I want to be respectful of that, because, you know, our diversities are different.
Yeah.
100%. I kind of went on a tangent there. That conference,
that's what we're here for.
That conference was awesome, and we've gotten some great connections through there, and I've gotten great resources, and I found a community there of people that accepted me. I felt like embraced me and took me for who I am. I don't have to be anything that I'm not.
Yeah.
I can be authentic. You know, they respect the STEM. If I need a STEM in a safe and appropriate way, I can STEM.
Yeah.
You know, and You know, if I need to step out, if I need to take a break, I need to take a break.
Yeah.
And I reached out to them when they were doing their conference, like, hey, I because the conference was done by the agency where we do our therapy. Right. And I was just like, you know, I love the conference and like, I would love to be a part of this in some way, somehow. So a few years ago, I asked them and they, as my occupation, I evaluate people trying to get a driver license. I'm a driver license examiner.
Okay.
for the State Department, for the State of California Department of Motor Vehicles. And just as a shout out, I'm not paid or endorsed by the California DMV to do any of this. So
yeah.
I'm doing this as a human and on my own.
Yeah.
And I was like, I noticed that like a lot of autistics were just not wanting, either fearful of driving or didn't want to drive, or just had too much anxiety about it. And I just like, just at the conference, I just reached out to him. Like, I'm interested in talking about something like this, because this is a topic in the autistic community.
Yeah.
And this is something that is relevant to us. And this is a community of autistics. What do you say? How do you feel about it? And they were on board. They're like, yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
So I did a little breakout session. I wasn't on the main stage, but I did a little sidebar session.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. I just shared my experiences. Hey, I'm an autistic that, you know, I have, even though I evaluate, I have my sensory issues too. Like,
yeah.
Like a sudden siren. It's like right there blaring. Okay. That could set me on edge.
Yeah.
As it would some others, you know, that sensory overload. But I did the session and it was great. I got a lot of great feedback in my session.
Cool.
And I say it was great feedback because I didn't have a whole lot of people, like maybe, I don't know, 10 or less people in there, but everybody in there asked me a question.
Yeah.
You know, and I figure if what you're presenting is relevant enough that every participant is asking at least one question or making at least one comment, that's a success.
Yeah.
You've made an impact. You've connected with somebody on some level.
And you sent us that link a while back.
Yeah, I did.
I watched that and it was cool. And for anyone who's listening, if you're cool with it, we'll put that link in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah. The more I can get the message out there, the better. You know, I think we spread the word to, I don't like the phrase spread the word in the word, but you know, knowledge is power. You know, the more, you know, the more you can make an informed, educated decision and shape your worldview.
So it's funny, like talking about driving. Oh, sorry, Drew, go ahead.
I think Ryan was going to ask the same question. Like, what are your findings? Summarize your findings as it relates to, I'm really interested about this because Ryan decided to drive later in life and loves driving. I fucking love driving. I'll drive anything, trucks, diesel, rear wheel. I just love it. Give me information about cars. So what were your findings as it relates to autistics in the motor vehicle licensing world?
A lot of it is the uncertainty.
Yeah.
How driving is so unpredictable, because you may know what you're doing,
yes,
but you don't know necessarily what the other person's doing. You trust that they know the rules and that they're going to follow the rules, but you can't be entirely certain that they're going to.
Yes,
that they know the rules, that they're going to follow the rules.
Yes,
and the sensory components, as I alluded to, like a sudden siren or sudden noise or sudden the car backfiring or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
If you're sensitive to noise and sounds, that can just set you off and that can just, that can put you in an overload. And then you just freeze. And if you're behind the wheel of a car and you freeze or start to have a meltdown, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And those are some of the anxieties that held up. And I know, and on the flip side, there's so many other autistics that are just like, so interested because finally, with driving, there is a set of rules. There's a set of rules that everyone's supposed to follow. That it's supposed to be the same rules for everybody else. There's a norm, if you will.
Yeah.
Everybody's supposed to follow. And, you know, there's finally some kind of order in the chaos and the order in the madness.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, great. There's finally some kind of order and stuff. But, you know, when somebody violates that order, oh my God, what do I do?
Yeah.
I personally love driving as well. I'm not licensed or anything to drive commercial vehicles. I just drive a regular car.
Yeah.
And no way on earth I'll ever drive a motorcycle. And
No interest.
Not in Southern California. No way. Even though the weather's great. Even though the weather's motorcycles. Great, the drivers aren't.
You do, right?
Yeah. It's funny because I didn't get my car driving license until I was about 35. I was terrified of driving. Like I had tried it a couple times, and like I got my beginner's license and I tried it a couple times, like, you know, with someone sitting beside you. And I just was like, nope, can't do it. I once drove for 20 minutes, like across the city, and I was at like 25 and I was like, nope, I never want to do this again. Like, this is too much. At 35, I got my license, and now I love driving. Like, if you're like, hey, can you go pick up a thing? It's a 10-hour drive. I'm like, I'll go. But I actually, at about 25, I did the motorcycle course, like a weekend course, and I fucking loved it.
Really?
And I still, to this day, like, I really, really, really want a motorbike. I never want to drive it in a city. But man, like country roads where, like, to me, the perfect thing is like a 2-lane road, because no one, you don't have to worry about people in other lanes with you.
Yeah, you just stay on the side
and you can just go on a 2-lane country road. To me, that's perfect, because all I got to worry about is like stop signs and you're just going in a straight line. Like, the road might curve, but you're just going. You know, I don't want to be in a city where there's traffic and turning right and left and people cutting you in and out. It's like, no. But yeah, like my job right now is an hour from my house, but it's pretty much one country road to get there. Like, I just get on that road and I take that road for an hour and I drive it all the time. And in the summertime, I always think, man, I would love to do this on a motorbike.
Hmm. Yeah, I could see it from that perspective, but I had a bad experience on a dirt bike when I was younger with my older brother I still remember, and it's like he was I think he was early teenager. This was way back in the day before you had to have a license to drive a motorcycle and that kind of stuff, and just he had gotten like this dirt bike, I think a little 2-cylinder thing or whatever, and was on a paved road. And then, you know, being young and looking up to your older brother and being like, oh, you're cool. You know, I want to be like you. I want to be a part of your world. I rode on the back and he went on there and he thought he would just, be a little adventurous and go off a dirt road that was not far from our house in an undeveloped area. And, did not know how to navigate that. And long story short, he misjudged it. We lost control. The bike went flying one direction. We fell off and we went flying another direction.
Yikes.
And I still can almost feel the cuts and scrapes and bruises and stuff as I talk about it. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
I'm done with that.
I can see.
I'm not doing that.
I could see never wanting to do that again.
Nah, hey, and I'm like, and just as even just riding a bicycle, it's like, yeah, I feel cautious riding a bicycle on a city street. It's like, you know, even though you got to share the road, people don't know that or realize that, or they simply don't care.
I would never ride a bicycle in a city. When I'm driving in the city and I see people riding bicycles, I just think you are basically just deciding you want to die. Like, it's so stupid to me. I don't understand why people do it.
I was in Toronto yesterday, Ryan, and I saw this dude, my buddy. I was just taking my buddy from the East End to the West End of Toronto.
Yeah.
And this guy was cycling beside us for like 10 minutes texting, no hands.
What?
And it's like this new thing in Toronto. Like I see it everywhere. People like texting their friends and changing their music with no hands while cycling. Like it's just
it's ridiculous. I once That's like went, okay, this is the story to me like about cycling in the city. Years ago, I was living in Toronto. I was probably, this is in like my early 20s. There's streetcar tracks everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
I saw a cyclist go get caught in a streetcar track and go down just as a streetcar was coming. And I was right beside it, and everything went in slow motion. And this person was on the ground, their legs twisted up in their bike. The streetcar ran over their bike and legs. So this person was like disappearing under the streetcar, looking up at me with these wide eyes, like and I was like trying to rush towards them to try to grab them.
What?
And I just see this face of total fear, like they're about to die. And it's like everything went in slow motion and the streetcar hit the brakes, but it covered over the person. And this these face and hands are reaching up to me. And I ran over and I like reached down as the streetcar stopped. I reached down and grabbed this person's hands and pulled him out. And just by like chance, his legs had not gotten under the wheels of the streetcar. Oh, they'd gone in between. And the bike was mangled. And I got this guy out and I pulled him to the side to the curb. And he couldn't speak. He was sitting there like convulsing, like shaking. And I just sat there and like put my hand around him and was like, "You're okay, man. Like, you're fine. You're going to be okay." And he couldn't even talk. He was just like, and then shocked. I just waited there until like a cop showed up. And then I was like, I was on my way to work. I was like, "Okay, I got to go. The cops are here now. Like, you're okay." And I walked to work and I was just like, I will never, ever, 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 ever ride my bicycle on city streets ever again. Like, yeah. I'll walk my bike to the trail along the lake and I'll ride there. But I'm never like riding on city streets. You're insane.
I just gave my speed bike to my friend recently. I was just like,
yeah,
I traded him for weed or something. I was like, take it.
Just imagine the PTSD. Oh man.
This person's shaking. And I was just like, this person just by chance isn't dead or didn't have their legs cut off. Like pure chance in that moment. Like
that's wild, Ryan.
So anyway, I don't know how we got there, but
you kind of alluded to it. Like I just recently got to a place in my driving career where if someone doesn't signal, I don't honk at them anymore. Where are you at?
Well, it's great you bring that up because that's my biggest pet peeve. Driving. That's always been my pet peeve ever since I first learned how to drive and up until now. Doing what I do and being a driver, that's my biggest pet peeve. It's like, great, you know where you're going. But I don't know where you're going.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to know where you're going? And how can I slow down and adjust? Yeah. Granted, I'm not supposed to be tailgating you, which I try not to do, but you got to let me know what you're going to do, where you're going to go so I can adjust if necessary, especially if we're going at a high rate of speed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to take me a lot more time and distance to slow down and react.
Yeah.
I've gotten to a place where I don't think I really honk at them unless it's super dangerous, unless they're like, oh, I got to turn right here. And it's like a split second decision where catastrophe could happen.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, I try not to honk. I may utter a few choice words at them. But you know, it's that catharsis. It gets that feeling, that emotion out in a safe and healthy way.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, you know, the only person that's really there to hear me is whoever's in the car with me.
The car.
I have to tell you that when I have my son in the car, because growing up, as he was younger, I didn't want to curse too much in the car. You know, I didn't want that to necessarily be my default. So trying to think of something more subtle and something that is impactful to get out the emotion some kind of term that would, you know, convey what I'm feeling, but be a word that if he said or he repeated it, it wouldn't be a bad word. He wouldn't get chastised for.
Yeah.
I call people kumquats.
Kumquats.
Kumquats. I'm like, you kumquat. And I would just say it, you know, and you know, it's not a bad word. It's just a fruit. But the way I said it and the way I convey the emotion, it gets out the feeling. It lets out like it
sounds kumquat. Vicious.
Kumquat. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
but I'm not saying you a-hole or you or anything that if he repeated he could get chastised or trouble for. If he's like, if you just call somebody kumquat, like, okay, you just call somebody a kumquat. No big deal.
Somebody does a really bad job driving, sometimes I'll just roll up beside them and I'll just be like, what you did back there, that was shit.
That was just
I'll just come up to him or something and I'll just like, if I'll just look over and I'll just roll my eyes and I'm like in disgust. I won't say anything, I just like you know, and like because then I put the onus on them. It's like whatever.
Yeah, deal with that if you can handle the eye contact.
You know, I'm an autistic that can do eye contact.
I don't avoid
eye contact.
Yeah.
It's taken a while. At restaurants when I was a kid, my mom was like, look at the waitress when she's talking to you. And I'm like, it's hard. Like, it's really hard. I'm struggling.
Yeah.
Well, I've had to learn how to do it. It was very difficult before. Because that's when my son was doing ABA, they were always like this kind of this forced compliance, you know, look at me and this stuff. It's like, no, why? I don't have to be looking at you to be listening to you, to knowing what you're saying.
Totally.
I don't particularly listen with my eyes.
Yeah.
You know, I listen with my ears and my body. Listen with the whole package. I don't have to just listen.
Yeah.
My eyes are part of it. My eyes aren't the entire thing.
I always say to people, like, do you have to look at the radio to listen to it?
Ah, good analogy.
Like to me, it's like if I have to look at you, it actually makes it harder for me to listen because the visual input dominates the audio input.
Right.
So you're talking to me and I'm just looking at your face and all of a sudden I get fixated on like your facial structure and how your mouth is moving and how your jaw is moving and how your face muscles are moving. And, oh, isn't it interesting how your cheekbones connect to this and your ears have this shape to them and your lips have this shape and your chin is shaped. And like, my eyes just start studying the structure of your face.
Yeah.
And then I just focus on that and your mouth's going like this, but I don't hear any of the sound coming out because the visual input buries the audio input underneath it. And then I'm just like, you finish talking and I just go, I don't know what you just said because you have a mole right here on your cheek. And I just stared at that for the last 4 minutes because that's the only thing I could see. So it's like, I actually will listen better if I'm not looking at you, but you know, that's
weird. I mean, how often are you listening to music and your headphones on, you're listening to the beats and you're just like with your eyes closed, just rocking.
Yeah.
Just rocking to the beat, you know, cause you're letting the music overtake you and you're letting the vibe control what you do. And oftentimes if I open my eyes and I let in that visual perception, I lose the vibe or I lose the meaning or I lose the good beat that I'm listening to. And it's like, exactly. And when I'm like you, Ryan, when I'm looking at somebody, I'm kind of studying their facial features. I'm like, okay, there's symmetry. Like, you know, I don't think anybody really has a perfectly symmetrical face.
No.
Very, very few people in the world, if any, do. It's like, you know, just like noticing the little subtleties of like, the imperfections and you know, and I'm like, you know, your imperfections are awesome. Imperfections are what make you unique and individualistic.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No,
I was just going to say, like,
I'm focusing on those things too.
For me, sometimes too, like, I find it easier to listen to people sometimes with my eyes closed. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm having a conversation and it's a little bit of a deeper conversation about like a serious topic or about like a concept or like a philosophical concept or a psychology or just something that's kind of a serious thing that I really want to focus on what you're saying, I want to just close my eyes and just kind of be like this and listen to you.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously, as we all have learned in our lives, that is not natural to neurotypical people. So like if you close your eyes, they go, well, you're not listening to me. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm not
giving you maximum listening.
Yeah, like you're not paying attention. And I'm like, I'm paying more attention with my eyes closed to what you're saying than not. But I'm aware that like if I'm at work or something and I'm talking to like the owner of the company and he's telling me something, I want to just close my eyes and listen to him, but I'm totally self-conscious of the fact that for him, that's really weird. So I don't do it, but it's like, I want to do it because I'll actually hear you better. But I'm just like in the last year, I'm kind of like, you know, as so many of us do when we discover like these techniques that we've, you know, picked up and developed of masking and fitting in. Like, I'm just starting to allow myself sometimes to do that when I speak to people that I'm comfortable enough with to just go, I'm going to just close my eyes when you talk and you have to decide whether or not you're comfortable with that, but I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
The neurotypicals, they don't understand that our sensory systems are the way we're wired, that we're taking in information and it's so fast and in so many ways.
Yeah.
And that it's faster than we can process that.
Yes.
By closing our eyes, that's helping us filter out.
Yeah.
Some of that information that's helping us focus and direct our energies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To what you're saying.
Yeah.
And that, there's nothing, I don't know why that's so wrong. I don't know why culture has been conditioned to say, you got to look at me. I think that's a bunch of BS. And I am like with my son, for example, I don't make him look at me when he's talking to me. You know, if he's like looking my direction, I'm assuming he's looking at me. I don't make him make eye contact with me.
Yeah.
As long as his voice is projecting my direction, that's fine. You know,
yeah.
I don't want to be talking to him and him having his back to me talking to the wall. I'm like, okay, I respect that. But if it's something that I really need you to understand or really communicate,
yeah,
I'd like you to at least turn around. You don't necessarily look at me.
Yeah.
But just try to look my direction. Not only so I can hear you a little bit better.
Yeah.
So to say, but just for my own sensory, my own processing.
Sure.
And it's like, you know, and I just let him be who he's going to be. I mean, I don't want to. The worst thing in the world are the helicopter parents. And God forbid I ever become one of them.
Do you have the one kid or do you have more too?
I just have the one. He's like 15 and a half and we're happy to have one. We just, there were some things early on. My wife, we've had some health issues that we were never able to have another one, but
yeah.
We're blessed with the one we have. We're grateful and
yeah,
you know, we're gonna, I think we're doing the best we can and
yeah,
doing what we know how to do.
One child as well. I have a daughter. She'll be six in a few weeks.
For sure.
Yeah, I It's amazing. I love it. And I'm blessed with the one, and that's great. And her mom and I are not together anymore, but we're both committed to her, my daughter, like, you know, like, and that's cool. And yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, it's funny, like, it's not funny. It's, you know, being sort of newly discovered autistic for the first few years of her life, I didn't know I was autistic. I mean, I had suspected for a long time, but now that I know, it's definitely changing my approach to parenting, because I think a little more conscious of my own sensory and communication issues and how that will play into my ability to parent with her and how I react to her and how, you know, things like that. And then I'm also find myself kind of on this, like, watching her to see if I see any autistic traits, kind of going, oh, she's doing, that's interesting how she's doing that. Or that's, you know, I don't, at this point, I don't think she is on the spectrum, but she does have a couple of traits that I've noticed that I go, huh, those could be indicators. But anyway, so that's just kind of fascinating. Her mom is not autistic. So, you know, it's a different world, but yeah, I don't know. There it is.
Yeah. My spouse and I, we co-parent. Our marital relationship is different. We just say we co-parent.
I don't
want to get into a whole lot of that, because how we define our relationship is our business, 100%. Nobody else's.
Yeah. I would never ask you for personal information that you don't freely offer.
I know. And we are committed to being the best parents we can.
Yeah.
For our son. And I noticed, you know, in my son, things that I did when I was younger, and that that led me to understanding and getting my autism diagnosis. And I noticed similarities, and what he does are things that I used to do when I was growing up, or you know, he's doing things and I'm like, did I used to do that or something? And I would ask my family, and they're like, well, yeah, to a degree or something. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. And I look at those as unique qualities and as gifts and as individualities. I don't look at them as imperfections or as any faults or anything. Like, that makes you who you are. That makes you unique, and that makes you one of a kind. And you are one of a kind. And never doubt that. Never question that. Yeah. Never let anybody tell you you're not. And never let anybody tell you you're not good enough. That you're not individual, and that you are not unique just the way you are. You are designed in a unique and wonderful way.
Yeah.
And we love you for it. And the people that trust you and respect you are going to love you for that.
Yeah.
No matter what, through thick or thin.
Yeah. 100%. And it's interesting to think about, because, like, on that topic, you know, so last year I started working with a coach. I don't know what you call it, like a life coach or something like this, right? Like, and in the initial couple of months of us working together, a lot of what we did were different exercises to sort of like figure out your patterns, figure out your behaviors, figure out your internal beliefs, figure out your values. And in doing some of these exercises, there were a few of them that were really, really powerful, that revealed a lot to me about my internal beliefs about myself that I had, that I was unaware of consciously. And a lot of that, like you talk about, that feeling of feeling like you're not good enough, feeling like you're broken, feeling like you're a failure, feeling like you'll never be good enough. Like, I had a lot of those beliefs internalized. And when you have those beliefs, when you feel like in yourself, you'll never be a success, nothing will ever work out, everything will always fall apart, you'll never be good enough, you sabotage everything. You're going to break everything you touch. Nothing good will ever stay in your life. Everything you try to create will fall apart. When you have those kind of beliefs, well, you manifest them in your life. You create situations where those beliefs become reality, because that's everything you're trying to build. If you already have this internal belief that it's not going to work, well, guess what? It's not going to work. And it's interesting to me to look back on and think about, well, where do those beliefs come from? And a lot of it comes from growing up undiagnosed autistic and trying to mask, trying to fit in, trying to be like everyone else, trying to protect myself from being picked on and bullied and seen as other, seen as different, you know, being made fun of by other kids, like all of that stuff, or even just like being misunderstood, like being a kid and having what I now look back on and realize was like a sensory overload caused like meltdown. But at the time, having your parents just go, oh, you're just trying to get attention, like snap out of it. Just do this, do that, go to your room. You're just being dramatic. You're just doing this. You're just doing that. And I remember being like a kid and my parents going like, oh, you're just trying to get attention. And I would think to myself, that's not what I want. That's not what I'm after. That's not what I'm doing. What you're telling me I'm doing is not what I feel like I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really know how to articulate that. So I look back on this stuff now in this last year, I've done a lot of like unpacking of all of this, of like understanding these beliefs I have, these internal things, and like where they come from. And a lot of it comes from that being undiagnosed autistic as a child and like forcing yourself to mask and pretend and try to fit in. So it's really awesome to me to hear you parenting your kid from a place of, hey, like you, I don't want my kid to have these internalized beliefs of being not good enough or being broken or that there's something wrong with you. Because my whole life, I thought there's something wrong with me. I always just thought, I don't know what it is, but there's something wrong with me. And like, yeah. I carried that for 40 plus years.
Yeah.
As so many of us have. And I'm still in the process of the last, say, 10 months of trying to undo that. But it's going to take a while because you can have the realization, go, oh, I see what happened there, but it's not that quick to just go, you can't just snap your fingers and undo 40 years of structured internal belief systems.
And so, bad habits, you know? And
bad habits you form around that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember the mantra, you must unlearn what you have learned, you know?
Yes.
Do the Yoda. And I had many of those same struggles and, you know, not feeling good enough, not feeling misunderstood and feeling like, you know, what do I have to do to be a part of this group? What do I have to do to fit in or feel normal?
Yeah.
And then as I've gotten older and hopefully gotten wiser, I realized I'm not going to fit in because I was designed to stand out.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to fit in because whatever fitting in looks like to you is toxic and repellent to me. And
yes. Yes.
I want no part of that. That is, if I fit in or I become part of that, I'm going to become similar or like you or like however you present yourself. And I don't want any of that.
Yeah.
And with our son, like the therapy agency that we use, and I'm going to give a shout out to them. They are they're called the Family Guidance and Therapy Center in San Diego, California. I have to give them a shout out.
Yeah.
They don't know I'm doing this, but hey, I'm going to plug them because they're awesome.
Cool. And anyone I'm listening, I'll find the website. I'll put the link in the show.
And room. I'm going to plug the two therapists that we've worked with that have been awesome. I'm going to give them a shout out. The first one, her name is Avra, A-V-E-R-R-I-A.
Yeah.
Martin. She was our first one. She transferred to another position, got a better opportunity and everything, but she was awesome. And our current one, her name is Megan, M-E-G-H-A-N, Murphy. She's our current therapist.
Yeah.
They are two amazing human beings. And if anybody's listening that ever has the opportunity to meet the two of them,
yeah,
you'll never go wrong.
I mean,
because we got to share the joy. I mean, you have to reach out to the people. I think you have to give a lot of, I try to embrace an attitude of gratitude.
Yeah.
In all of my life, you know, not because it's the quote unquote right thing to do, but it just, as you mentioned, Ryan, what I internalize is what I become.
Yeah.
What I believe and what I manifest.
Yeah.
And if I manifest good vibes and good energy, if I manifest good things in my life and I share that manifestation with others and to others,
yeah,
then that's what's going to breed, that's what's going to grow, and that's what's going to bloom.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to see in the world. Not,
yeah,
I want to see that in the world for everybody, but I especially want to see that in the world for myself, and I want to see that in the world for my family and for my son.
Yeah.
I want him growing up in a world where he's accepted for who he is.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he doesn't need to change. He doesn't need to be anything different. The world needs to look at things through a different lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember growing up, I was younger, like I said, wanting to fit in. And I remember this one particular instance when I was a kid in grade school. The grade school thing at recess is to play kickball. And I always loved playing kickball. I was never really great on offense, but I was great on defense. I was great out in the field. And, you know, you get these like pseudo wannabe jocks and wannabe popular kids are like, oh, you're the weird kid. You know, we don't want you on our team or anything like that. You know, it's like, we're only letting you play because the teacher's watching or because we feel like we have to, because, you know, we're going to get in trouble or they're going to talk to us or whatever, you know, that nonsense. And I remember one time, you know, I was one of those kids that always got picked last. Yeah. Good for us.
Hey, I was that kid too.
Hey, I don't mind being the kid that gets picked last. You know, yeah. I don't care.
Yeah.
And they underestimated me. And I had played a little bit of baseball when I was younger. And, you know, my brain was able to conceptualize and take the elements of baseball into the elements of kickball. It's like, you know, there's a lot of similarities, the patterns and defense and, you know, similar strategies. And I remember being in the outfield. And this was like when I was in third or fourth grade. Because we played on there were two different playgrounds, one for the upper grades, one for the lower grades.
Yeah.
At my school. And I remember this was the lower grade one. And I was in the outfield. I was in the outfield because they're like, oh, just go stick him out in the outfield. Just go stick him out there. And this person this wannabe pseudo jock popular kid thought he would try to kick in my direction, be like, oh, he can't do anything here.
It's just,
this is going to be an easy run. This is going to be an easy thing. And he kicks it my direction. And I'd played baseball before and I'd been in the outfield and I had pretty good depth perception, I thought.
Yeah.
And I was able to follow where the ball was going and I was aware and I saw it. And then I remember suddenly I was right there where the ball was coming down and this big gust of wind came and started to take the ball.
Oh, wow.
Further back. And I remember jumping up.
Whoa.
And putting my hands up in the air and catching the ball between my hands above my head and the wind taking the ball. And like carrying me with it because, you know, I'm a little scrawny elementary kid. And, like, going back and coming down and able to bring the ball in.
Amazing.
And held on to it as I was falling to the ground and got the out. And everybody was like, oh, yeah, good job, and everything. And, you know, I don't know what that kid's response was or whatever. I didn't really give a damn.
Yeah.
I just, like, you know, I score one for the little, the little guy. You know? And I represent, and I was like, oh, it just felt so great. And
so awesome.
I want those little moments and little opportunities for everyone. You know, they don't have to be big, gigantic, or anything, but I especially want those for our community.
Yeah.
You know, because we don't get those praises. We don't get those accolades.
Sorry, my coffee just went right through me. I'll be right back. Talk amongst yourselves.
Yo, Dave, I was just thinking, like, it's so funny how it's a little bit off topic, but, like, when you started bringing up the kickball, I had flashbacks to the big thing in my junior school was foot hockey. Okay. And so, you know, whether you have a tennis ball or a slightly harder ball, it didn't matter the season. Even when there was snow, we would push the snow away with shovels. And it was that very similar environment of like almost like a caste system happening within the game. And I think that's why those memories get imprinted the way they do. They happen at such a vulnerable, precarious age. Like, I can't remember half the shit I did in high school, but I remember that foot hockey game.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think there's something there with, like, these unlikely hero stories where, like, you just talk to regular people and they bring up their, like, childhood glory stories.
Well, we all have those stories.
Yeah.
Whether we remember them or not, and whether they're traumatic or not, you know, hopefully. I mean, hopefully we all have those stories, and hopefully you have more positives than you do negatives. But just, we all need those little successes. And because I think you can only build and grow on success, you know? Yeah. I mean, you got to have the balance. You got to have the successes with the setbacks and everything. But if you use the setbacks to learn from and to support the successes, then that's how you develop, and that's how you grow, and that's how you excel, and that's how you succeed. That's something. Yeah. And this was in the middle. I mean, I live in Southern California now, but I grew up in the Midwestern United States. I grew up right in the middle. I grew up in Kansas. So right in the middle where we got four seasons of weather. And now
snow in Kansas?
Yeah, it snows like not as much as, I mean, I don't know how it does now with climate change or whatever, because I'll say it here, I believe climate change is real. I'm not a denier. And I don't know what it's like. I don't know if it snows so much there now. I think it did then. I think it has a little bit more because my family still lives out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it snowed fair enough. No, nothing like the northern parts of the country or Canada. But we got four seasons of weather there.
Mm-hmm. But just back to your point, Dave, I think like the more adults, like this is sort of how the podcast started. It was like the more adults that own and love and celebrate their autism, like Ryan and yourself, and like indirectly myself through the show, it's like, if younger kids have those outlets or those people, those athletes, those NASCAR drivers, whoever it is that are saying, hey, this is a great thing actually. And let's make this a positive as you're parenting, like in a positive way. You're not saying no, no, no. You're saying yes, yes, yes. And the more of that we get, I think we will have hopefully a more accepting place, society.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want that. I think there's too much negative language already, and we need more positive language. And
yeah,
if you grow up learning negative language and hearing no, 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 or can't or won't or any of that,
or why of that jazz, why can't you
shame,
why can't you just do this? Why can't you be more like them? Why? It's not that hard. Why are you struggling so much?
Yeah. Why does it take you so long to do this?
Yeah.
Because I want to do it correctly. How about?
Because I have it, because this is the way I do it. And yeah. Yeah. This is, and my response kind of to that is like, do you want it done quickly or do you want it done accurately?
Yeah.
Because you can't necessarily have both in the same context. And, you know, and I when I was younger, I got, you know, chastised for being combative like that, you know.
Yeah.
Are you talking back to me? I'm like, no, I'm just clarifying, and I'm just trying to get you to understand that how you're asking the question or what your expectation is,
yeah,
and what my expectation is, so we can try to have some cohesion, so we can kind of have some harmony. You know, I'm not back talking. I'm not trying to make things difficult. I'm just clarifying. And it's like, you know, if you want me to half-ass it, I will.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if I want to be passive aggressive.
I don't want to.
That's a whole other show.
But a lot of me is like, no, I'm not going to do that because I'm not going to compromise my worth, my values, my dignity, if you will, to appease you. It's no, you have no right to ask me to compromise who I am to fit your narrative or to fit your norm or to fit whatever you want, you know. It's like, how would you feel if somebody did that to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's just so many, there's so much entitlement in this world.
This is like triggering me about my relationship, but I mean, there are so many instances where I'm not shitting on anybody. It's not, I'm just kind of, this is more humorous to me now, but like so many instances in my last relationship with my daughter's mom where like I would be doing something a certain way and then she would criticize me for the way I'm doing something. And I remember just saying to her, I go like, do you want me to do it or do you want it done your way? You got to pick one, because you can't ask me to do it and ask me to do it your way. That's just not going to work. So it's like either like, and it'd be something, even something as simple as like, I'm being told I'm doing the dishes wrong, you know? And I'd just be like, well, I'm just doing the dishes the way it makes sense for me to do the dishes. And if it doesn't make sense for you, like, I'd rather you not criticize me, because it's in the grand scheme of things, who gives a fuck? Mm-hmm. I would never walk in and see you doing the dishes and think to myself, well, why are you doing it that way? Like, that doesn't make sense. Let me take this time to tell you how to do the dishes. I just wouldn't bother. I'd just be like, okay, cool, you're doing the dishes. I'm going to go do something else now. Like, I'll go clean the bathroom or like whatever it is. So it's funny to me, because I think that happens a lot in life where like people will look at you and go, well, why are you doing it that way? And it's just like, why do you have to comment? Like, it's literally
just be grateful I'm doing it.
What's that?
Just be grateful that I'm doing it.
Just be like, okay, cool. You're doing it. You know what I mean? Like it's funny. Like even just like, oh man, even like a month ago, she was dropping my daughter off at my house and I was outside like raking the lawn, and she showed up and started criticizing the way I was raking the lawn.
What?
And I just looked at her and I'm just like, I didn't say anything. I just was like, whatever. But in my head, I'm just like, I can't imagine having an opinion about how you do anything. Like it just doesn't, it wouldn't, if I was dropping my daughter off at your house and you were raking your lawn, I can't imagine having the desire to even form an opinion about how you're doing it, let alone express that opinion. I just, it doesn't, I don't. And anyway, I'm not shitting on anyone. I'm really not. This is, you know, like my daughter's mom. There's a lot of respect there. There has to be.
Yeah.
But it's more just an observation about what I think of as like some neurotypical behavior, which is like this desire to like criticize how you do a thing. And it's just like, who gives a fuck? Like literally, who gives a fuck? If no one's getting hurt, it does. And if it takes me 2 hours to do it this way, but you think it would only take me an hour to do it a different way, because that's the better way, because it's your way, who fucking cares?
Yeah, do it. You fucking do it then. If you want it done that
way. And the thing about my brain, my autistic brain, is every task I do, I might do it slightly different each time because I'm running a constant experiment on how to do that task. Yeah. So I might go, I'm going to try it a little bit different this way, and it might take longer, but I might figure out one aspect of that that makes more sense to me. And over the course of years, I might, by little tiny increments, be tweaking a certain task to try to make it more and more efficient and effective over time. But in those experiments, sometimes it might be less effective or less efficient because of those tweaks, but then those, you know what I mean? It's just like an ongoing thing. Like,
If somebody's hovering over your fucking shoulder, you're not going to be able to conduct the experiment.
No, and you can't even think. I can't even think if I'm worried that somebody's criticizing how I'm doing it, because I'm like, and I might be doing something in a wrong way, but I might know that already because I'm doing an experiment about how to do it in this wrong way to see if I can learn something. It's like,
that's one reason that I enjoy the job that I do right now, because I'm not inside an office all day with all that noise and all that hovering and all that.
Hey Dave, did you get your TPS? Clatter. Dave, we didn't get your TPS report yet. When are you going to get that into us?
Yeah.
Monday.
Well,
it's like, yo Dave, how do you, like, I can tell that, like,
shout out to Office Space.
Yeah.
They're watching. They're listening.
Yo, they are.
Dave, how do you, like, it sounds like from your energy that, like, you know, you grew up, like, with at least one parent that was neurotypical.
Yeah.
And like, so how do you deal with, like, earlier in the conversation you talked about toxic energy. Like, if someone's obviously toxic in your life, do you keep them in your life? And if the answer is yes, how?
Well, I keep them in my life if I have to, I minimize the relationship that I have with them. And I have the relationship with them on my terms.
Yeah.
And, if it's necessary, if it's not necessary, then I'm like, I distance myself from them, either cut it off right away, or I just gradually disassociate.
Yeah.
Growing up, both my parents were, but my mom was a homemaker daycare provider. She did home daycare out of the house.
Yeah.
And my dad worked graveyard shift at a factory.
Yeah.
And during income tax season, he was a tax preparer for H&R Block.
Hmm.
My dad grew up in a small town in Minnesota, and his family still lives there. My mom grew up in Kansas, and I have an older brother, an older sister, and a younger brother. And all of my immediate family still lives out in Kansas. Mm. I'm in Southern California, more closely connected with my spouse's family, because my family's just, we don't keep in touch much, a whole lot, because they, we just have different worldviews. We just have different ways of, our lives are just taking different directions. And I've tried to reach out, but they haven't. I put the ball in their court, if you will, but they haven't volleyed it back. Or if they do, it's not at a, if they do volley the ball back, it's like oh, I forgot that I put the, I forgot I sent the ball over there. You know, it's just so delayed that we just, and so I kind of have a love, hate, lukewarm relationship with them.
Yeah,
I feel that.
And my parents were, I think both of my parents were neurotypical. I can't think of any specific things or traits about them that would make me believe that they weren't.
Yeah.
And, but, I'm adopted, and I found out that years ago, just about maybe 7 to 10 years ago, that my, aunt, my mom's sister was actually the, is actually my birth mom.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know that. It was a closed adoption. And this was back in the 70s where, having a kid out of wedlock was taboo and was just not, it was just, and the culture I grew up in, that was wrong. That was,
yeah. Especially in Kansas.
Well, just in my family, I grew up in a college town, so it was a little more liberal, but our family was, that just, it was just a thing. And it, you know, I could have gone to a really dark place, and I could have gone to a place of like real hatred and animosity and just been like, you know, fuck you. You know, it's like, you know, been like, you lied to me.
Kumquats.
Yeah, exactly. And it could have been like, you know, I could have like just disassociated, you know, I could have felt like really betrayed.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I was at a happy place in my life, and I was at a place in my life that I wasn't going to let that end my life, you know, because I had seen how there's absolutely nothing positive about adopting that mindset, adopting that attitude, and embracing that energy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, as my spouse and I like to say, we ain't got no time for that shit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want that in my life, because, you know, if I embrace that, that's what I'm going to manifest. That's what I'm going to breed. And that's what I'm going to share on to my son. I'm going to share those values, that belief, that attitude, either directly or indirectly onto him. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't want to shape his beliefs and attitudes for him. I want him to develop those on his own. Yeah. You know, I want to guide him, but I don't want my crap or whatever to be his crap.
Yeah.
And that's not fair to him. And
well, it's not healthy for you.
Never do that.
It's like that quote that's always attributed to the Buddha. I don't know if it is or actually something he said or not, but it's like that quote about, like, you know, holding onto a grudge is like drinking poison and thinking the other person's going to die. It's like,
yeah,
it's that you're holding on to like negative energy around somebody else. It does nothing for you. It does nothing for your own health, for your own growth, your own development, your own happiness, your own fulfillment. It just limits yourself, and the other person is unaware of it. They don't even, like, they're not feeling it. So it's like, it literally is like drinking poison. And it's it makes no sense.
They could care less, you know.
They don't give a shit. They're dancing.
It's like, yeah, you're an afterthought or whatever.
Yeah.
And then back in the year 2000, my mom, who I call the woman who raised me my mom. The woman who gave birth to me is my aunt.
Yeah.
Even though my mom and my aunt are sisters, my mom is the one who raised me. And
that's your mom.
Yeah, she's my mom.
Yeah.
Sadly, she passed away in the year 2000 from cancer at a young age.
Sorry to hear that.
And I had just, I think that was kind of for my family, that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will. Okay. Because that was the time that I was finishing, that was around the time that I was finishing college and I was starting my own adult life, starting my own journey. Yeah. And I was starting to spread my wings and leave the nest.
Yeah.
And my, without getting into too much detail, I think my dad married somebody else on the rebound.
Yeah.
And things are just severed and falling apart. I don't have a whole lot of contact with my family anymore. Yeah. Out there, my wife's family is my family now.
They're
the people that they're emotionally invested in me.
They're
the people that I'm emotionally invested in.
Yeah,
they're the ones that they got my back, if you will.
Yeah,
and they're the ones that that I know love me unconditionally and
will
do anything for me. But going back to the whole thing, like I didn't notice any traits here, anything in any of my siblings, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing autistic. If anything, my two brothers, they try to. As an adult now, looking back in a different lens, they're kind of like the alpha male stereotype, you know, that vulnerability is weakness and crap, which is a bunch of bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, I know I've learned that the more vulnerable I am, the stronger I am.
Because
the more I let people in, the more people I know what my insecurities are, what my deficits are, where my weaknesses are,
the better.
The more I own them,
The
more I can get the assistance and guidance I need, and the more doors that are open, the more avenues are available to me. And, you know, I was kind of hesitant about that, disclosing that I was autistic at first because of all the stigma and such, especially as an adult in a professional environment. It's everything, you know.
Yeah.
All I could think of at first was like the backstabbing, the discrimination, the gaslighting, all of the everything that's gonna, all the backlash, if you will.
Yeah. And like, how can people use this against me?
Exactly. And then I was like, you know, people don't control me. I control me.
Yeah.
And I have enough people in my life that will support me and will go to the bat for me and will fight tooth and nail for me emotionally, relationally, socially.
Yeah.
You know, my medicine is stronger than your poison. And I'm not, you can be who you're going to be, but this is who I am. And I'm going to live authentic. You don't decide who I am. I decide who I am.
Yeah.
You don't decide how I perceive or what I believe or how I present. I decide that.
Yeah.
And those that want to be in my inner circle, great. They're going to be a part of it and they're going to embrace that.
Yeah.
Those that don't want to be, well, great. That's your choice. It's nice knowing you, but we can't have that harmony.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have to you have to give up. You have to adapt a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's tricky, man, with the family stuff. Like, I have two brothers and I wouldn't say we have a bad relationship, but we just don't talk. Like we just, one of them lives an hour away and we just don't even talk to each other. It's not bad. If we did see each other, it's not like we're fighting. It's like, we'd be like, hey, how's it going? Good. How are you? Okay. But it's just,
dude, I've known you all this time and I've never knew you had siblings.
What's that?
I've known you all this time and I didn't
know you had siblings. And then and it's more like he's an acquaintance. And and then my other brother lives farther away, and we talk slightly more often, but we're not close these days. And I've found it's been interesting in the family dynamic in the journey of autism discovery is, it can be a really interesting thing. Is I've discovered that nobody's interested. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody's interested. None of my family have ever asked me any questions about this. Whenever I bring it up, it's like, they change the subject, or they just don't want to talk about it. Or one of my brothers just straight up told me I'm not autistic, and that I'm just, what did he say? I forget what he said exactly, but you know, I'm making it up and
gaslighting me,
you know. And I'm like, well, you know, I've spent like the last 2 years like researching this topic heavily and reading like a dozen different books and devouring hundreds of hours of audio and lectures and podcasts and reading articles online and having discussions online with people and doing different testing online and all of this stuff. And then he said, well, you're just getting hyperfixated on this. And I was like, do you know that hyperfixation is an autistic trait? Just like, oh, you're not. And his thing was like, and then another thing was, you know, and I will say this, my former partner, while I was going through this process, was telling me that, oh, you're just looking to make excuses. You just want to make excuses and for things. And I was like, well, that's actually the opposite of what I want to do. And it's like, I have, and I would use this analogy. I'm like, if somebody had trouble reading their whole life and everyone was like, called them stupid and said, well, why can't you just figure it out? It's not that hard. And why can't you spell and blah, blah, blah. And then at the age of 40 something, that person discovered that they were dyslexic and said, hey, I've discovered this. I'm dyslexic. That's why I've had all this trouble reading. Oh, you're just making excuses. You just want attention. You're just making it up. You're not trying hard enough. And it's like, well, no. The reason I'm happy that I've discovered I'm dyslexic is so now I can learn how to learn to read and write better, coming from a place of knowledge of knowing I'm dyslexic. That makes more sense to me. And that's kind of like what I would say to her and other people about my journey towards autism. It's like, I didn't just pick something out of a hat and go, oh, autistic, I'm going to be autistic. Like it's not putting on a new hat. It's like, it's not a thing I wanted. It's like a thing that my whole life I was like, what is going on with me? Like, what is it that I can't figure out? And I was like, do I have anxiety? Do I have depression? Am I bipolar? Do I have this? Do I have that? Like, there's something different. And then when I finally read, I swear I mentioned this book every single episode, but I finally read Late Diagnosis of Asperger's Syndrome by Philip Wiley. Sorry, I'm just looking at it to see the title. I finally read that book, and every single page I was like, holy shit, this is me, this is me, this is me, this is me, this is me. And as like, I wasn't looking for that. I didn't want to be autistic. It's not a fashionable thing. It's like, no, I just, after 40 years of wondering what's going on, I finally found something that all of a sudden everything else made sense. My sensory issues, my communication issues, my depression, my anxiety, like all of it all of a sudden fit under this umbrella. And I went, oh, and it was like this sigh of relief of like, oh, I get it now. Now I can like move forward with this understanding and be more effective and better in my life. That's why I want this information, not to make excuses, not because I don't want to change, but that was, you know, anyway, sorry. I know I get long winded, but I find that fascinating. You know, like I said, one of my brothers just straight up said to me, like, you're not autistic. You're just looking for like making something up. And I was just like, why would I do that? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
I echo everything you just said.
Yeah.
My brothers are more like acquaintances. You know, if there's any communication, it's all one way. I have to initiate it. Yeah. Nobody ever calls me or uses social media or anything.
Yeah.
With me, and it's like, but that's why, you know, our relationship is not as ideal as it could be.
Yeah.
And such. And same, I talk more with my sister, but whenever I have to initiate the conversation with her.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm talking with her, I love her to death and everything, but she just seems to just go on about her problems and about her issues. And it's like, you know, with all due respect, I appreciate that. And I understand that, but there's more to life than what you don't have, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, there's more to life than your issues.
Yeah.
And you know, I grew up with like all those, the sensory issues too. And being like really having like things I can't stand. I mean, there's things that I still can't stand today. Like, for example, like onions, I can't stand onions. I can't stand the smell of them.
Yeah.
I can't stand the taste of them. I can't stand the texture of them. I can barely stomach the look of them.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't want them anywhere in my food. The only way I'll eat them is if I can't taste them or if I can't feel them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then
I'm the exact same way, but with tomatoes. It's like, I don't even want to look at a tomato. I don't want to, if I even think about cutting into one, I'm like, oh. But
wow.
It's like the only way I can have it is, like you said, if it's buried under a bunch of other shit and I don't notice it.
Yeah. And others like, you don't like onions? I'm like, no. It's like, and, you know, there's smells and such that I just can't.
Yeah.
I can't stand. There's sounds, you know.
Like if the smoke alarm goes off in my house, I have to go somewhere quiet. Like, we have a smoke alarm that goes off, and it's like, it takes like a half an hour to shut off, and I have to leave the house.
I get those issues too. And there's certain smells that I like or whatever that other people either don't like, or they're like, you're weird for liking that smell. Like the smell of gasoline.
Yeah.
At the pump. It's
like it.
I don't mind it, but yeah. I mean, I don't go seeking out that smell, of course, but it doesn't bother me. It doesn't do anything. And like, I don't have any aversion to it.
Yeah.
And others are like, they don't. And
Dave, and I just pictured you rolling up to a gas station with a full tank and just hanging out for a couple minutes beside someone filling their tank.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And then I had to talk, well, you know, they add that smell, right? And I told people, you know, they add that smell so you can distinguish what it is.
Oh, really? So
it's naturally odorless and colorless.
Oh, I didn't know that. Like,
they add that to you so you can tell what it is.
Really?
If there's an emergency.
That's amazing. You know?
And and you know, those are different things, like, you know, different kinds of clothing and textures and feelings,
yeah.
You know? Certain things I don't like to wear and I won't wear. And there's something else that you mentioned that I was going to talk about that it just eluded me.
Sensory wise?
Is it sensory wise?
Or siblings? Is it about siblings?
I don't know. Maybe it'll come back to me.
Yeah.
But there's, and well, going back to the sensory things, my spouse's family, they're foodies. They like to explore with food and try different kinds of food and different things. Her sister, for example, makes these amazing gourmet cheesecakes. You know, they just, they like experiment, explore with food, and I don't. It's like, I like to keep it the simpler, the better, you know. Yeah. If it, the less it, the more it gets away from what I know and I perceive as food, the less I want to eat it.
Yeah.
And the less I'm going to try to eat it.
That's funny.
And the more complicated it is, the less I'm going to want to eat it. Yeah. You mentioned all these ingredients. It's like, okay, I stop listening, you know, because I stop being interested.
I'm like, I it's funny. I can relate. Like, I have no interest in food at all. Like, to me, it's just putting gas in the car. It's like, I'm hungry. Food, I need energy. I have to eat something, but I've never cared about food. I have friends who are like, they'll be like, oh, we got to go to this restaurant. It's so amazing. You're going to love it. And I go there and they're like, oh, you got to order this. You got to order that. And we have to get this appetizer. You have to try it. It's so amazing. And I'll try everything. And everyone's like, oh, what do you think? What do you think? Like, they're all excited. And I'm like, it's all lost on me. I just don't get it at all.
Yep.
I don't care. I remember like years ago, one of my good friends, he was a musician and he got signed to this record company. So they were taking him out for this celebratory dinner. Mm-hmm. So he had just broken up with his girlfriend or she was out of town or something. I forget. So he brought me as his date, right? Like, he's like, yo, you want to come out? Because they were going to this like super fancy, expensive restaurant. Like the kind, like, it was like, I think five or six of us at this dinner. And it was like a $1,500 bill, you know, like just crazy. And I'm sitting there like, I don't know what to order. I just take whatever the waiter recommends. And these little plates come and everything's like tiny and weird looking. And I'm eating it all. And everybody's like freaking out like, ooh, isn't this the best thing you've ever had? And I'm just going along with them going, oh my God, this is so amazing. But in my head, I'm just like, I don't get any of this. There's nothing special here. It's like, I think afterwards, like my buddy and I left the dinner and like 2 hours later, we were in some pub where I just like, we both just had like a burger and fries too. Cause we were just like, I'm still hungry. Like it doesn't make sense. Anyway.
Yeah. So I would hear terms like crudité and I'm like, what is crudité?
Yeah.
What is it? What does that mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still not sure I am clear on what that even is.
veggies and dip.
No onions. And no onions.
What?
No onions in that.
No onions.
Yeah. No onions.
And I'm kind of that way with beer. I mean, I like beer, but I don't like really hoppy beer.
Yeah.
The hoppier it is, the less I like it.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big IPA fan and I'm not a big stout fan. I'm more of a lager and a pilsner.
Lager. Yeah.
Lager and a pilsner. Yeah. I'm cool with that. And, you know, I don't want some cheap mass produced beer. I don't want swill, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I want like a nice craft beer, a nice beverage that's pleasing to the palate that I want to drink, that I enjoy, you know.
Makes sense.
And something like that.
Do you have any underdeveloped senses? Like for me, my sense of smell is underdeveloped. Like I if there's like a, you know, a spill or a gas leak or something, like I'm always the last to know. If there's like a fire, there's smoke, I'm the last to know. Everyone else will be like, oh, do you smell that? I'm like, nope. And like, so I have an underdeveloped sense of smell, which I've always had, which probably is the big reason why I don't care about food, because smell is such a big part of taste where I'm just like, whatever. But do you have any, like, do you have any senses that are either like more acute or less developed?
I would say my sense of smell might be over acute because I'm really sensitive to smells. I think my hearing, depends on if I'm hearing what am I hearing or listening for? Am I hearing or listening for understanding or enjoyment? Yeah, it depends on if I'm engaged.
Yeah.
You know, maybe my sense of touch, like I can touch something that's hot, for example, and it not be, I don't feel the heat of it or have to pull my hand away as quickly as somebody else might have to.
Yeah.
I can maybe tolerate that a little bit more.
Yeah.
And well, with sight, I have really a good, I'm really farsighted and, I really struggle with nearsightedness.
Okay.
And it's really great when my spouse and I, when we were younger and we were in the car and driving, back before we had navigation, there's this thing called the Thomas guide. Do you guys know what that is? It's a Thomas Guide is like a map with like a spiral on it.
Okay, yeah.
It's a paper map. Yeah. Where you cross it lets you cross reference your streets and such to find out where you go.
Yeah.
It's like it's what you use before GPS and navigation.
Yeah, we had something similar here. Yeah.
Yeah. And we use that all throughout Southern California before.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how do I get here without bypassing? How do I get here bypassing the freeway and such? Well, you go here to here and then you have to cross reference. Well, my spouse and I were driving one time, at least one time. And, you know, she's almost to the degree that I'm farsighted, she's nearsighted. She'd be looking, she'd be like, we got to take exit, whatever. And like, it's about maybe a quarter mile down the road. I'm like, okay, that's the exit coming up. And she's like, you can read that? I'm like, yeah, that's really clear for me to read. She's like, how can you see that? I'm like, and then she's like looking at the Thomas Guide without any corrective lenses. And I'm like, how could you read that? You know? And it's like, you know, that yin and that yang or whatever, you know. Yeah, I can see that totally down the road. And I'm like, you know, so I can start preparing to exit and such.
Yeah.
He's like, I could never read that. And I'm like, well, I would struggle to read this without having my glasses on or something.
That's funny. What about you, Drew? Do you have any, your sensories, do you find any are heightened or less?
I was going to make a really bad joke earlier and say my sense of humor was pretty acute. That's just,
that'd be awesome.
I'd say smell. I'm like you, Dave. Like it brings me back to yesterday. My wife decided to clean everywhere with apple cider vinegar. And I just was like, literally came in and I didn't mean to do this like some kind of an inspector, but it was just so I would say pungent that, you know, mind you, she had cleaned and she'd gotten used to the smell. I wonder if she'd, you know, had the same experience, been away from the house and come in.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm really sensitive to smell and touch. It's weird. Like sometimes when other people touch me in a way that I feel is like inappropriate or aggressive, I'm really taken aback by that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, with touch, it's like, who's touching me? Who's touching me? And, and how are they touching me? And am I prepared for, or am I expecting it? You know, just some random family member that I don't see that often, for example, coming up and wanting to give me a hug. It's like, whoa, step back. It's like, you know, I don't have that relationship with you. You know, I don't have that connection with you. And I'm kind of touch averse. I don't like that. Yeah. You know, if I know you well and, you know, you've accepted that boundary and you've let me initiate that contact with you on my terms and been respectful of that, then we can give each other a hug randomly.
Yeah.
Whenever. You know, I kind of really had to learn that with my wife's family is a lot of huggers. My spouse's family, a lot of huggers. And you know, that's how they greet and everything. And she's got a larger family than I do. Lots of cousins and such.
Yeah.
And that's how they greet and interact, and that's how they're cordial with another. And I'm like, yeah, that's not my norm. That's not my thing. That's not what I grew up with. That's not how I interact. And I've had to teach people that, okay, that's not my jam. And there's people now that I'll go and I'll give a hug to, you know, just because they've respected that boundary and they've let me make the first move. And then going back to what you were talking about, the cleaning, you know, in our household, we try to use a lot of natural cleaners and such. And I try to do a lot more homemade and holistic cleaners and such. You know, we try to limit the amount of chemicals in our house because They're overall not safe.
Yeah.
And with my spouse's health issues and all of our sensory issues, it's like, why?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the household products can be just as effective as the others. And plus, why do I want to make some big chemical company richer if I don't have to?
Yeah, exactly.
And well, so, I mean, I love apple cider vinegar. I love the smell of apple cider vinegar.
Yeah. You know,
I use apple, and when I wash my hair with baking soda. I just use a baking soda wash.
Wow.
Scrub it, and I use an apple cider vinegar conditioning rinse.
Oh, wow.
That's the secret. That's the secret.
Totally natural. There the secret to that's the secret to the thickness. There it is.
There it is. I wish I knew that secret 20 years ago. Well, I was going to say, too, like talking
better late than never.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, too, like talking about touch, I find with touch, like, just an example, like I could be sitting there with somebody and like I find this really weird because I experienced this with my former partner a lot. Like she would think nothing of physically moving me. If she wanted me to move over, she wanted me to move my arm, like she would just grab my arm and move it. And like for me, that's like an assault.
Yeah.
Because it felt like an act of aggression, which maybe it was in retrospect, I don't know. But I would go, hey, you can't just pick up my arm and move it. You got to tell me and say, hey, can you move your arm, please? I'll happily move my arm.
Yeah.
Or my leg or whatever it is. Like if I'm sitting on the couch and for whatever reason you want to change your position and you want me to move my leg, like she would just grab my leg and push it over. And I would just be like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah,
like,
let's fucking talk.
You can't. So I don't know if this is just a me thing or if this is like an everybody thing. But I remember having these conversations where I'd be like, yo, like you can't, like to me, like when I'm not expecting it and you just grab a part of my body and push it, it's like that is like it to me, that feels like an act of aggression. It feels like an assault. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to react well to that. I'm going to be like, what the fuck are you doing? Like. Mm-hmm. You don't just push me.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you know, if whatever. And we'd have these conversations and it would be like, well, you know, what's the big deal? I just moved your arm. And I'm like, yeah, but you're not just moving my arm. You're grabbing my arm and moving it. And I don't know that's about to happen. And it feels aggressive to me. So can you not do that? Like, can
you're not respecting my personal space.
Can you respect like my ownership of my body? And it would never in a million years occur to me that I would ever just reach over and grab a part of your body and move it. Like I would say, hey, I'm going to shift my position. Can you move your arm? I would never just grab it and push it. It's like, so I don't know. I don't know if that's just,
would you do that to a stranger? Would you do that to somebody you don't know? Absolutely not. Of course. And I approach things with that kind of mindset. If I wouldn't do this with somebody I don't know or somebody that's a stranger, what on earth even makes me think that I have license to do it with somebody I do know?
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of thing, you know, just moving somebody's stuff, you know,
it's like,
you know, what's there is there. For a reason, maybe a reason you don't understand or you don't realize or whatnot, but whatever's there is there for a reason, consciously or unconsciously. But don't just move something without asking if you can move it. Mm-hmm. And then if so, don't move it without telling somebody where you're moving it to.
Yeah.
You know, because
so many
be like later, it's like, well, where's this whatever? And it's like, I moved it over there. I'm like, well, hey, did I tell you can move it or did I say to move it over there? It's like, you know, why not? And that with my spouse and I, that's been kind of one of our struggles.
Yeah.
In our relationship.
Funny, like when you're cohabitating with people, like another one of my struggles is like, I have dyspraxia too. And it's like, I have a
difficult time navigating where I am in space in relation to what's around me. Like, I frequently walk through doorways and bang my shoulders on the edges of the doorways. Like, I trip on things. I'm always stepping on stuff, knocking stuff over and banging into things because I don't know where my body is in space. And I would try to have these conversations with her of like, or with anyone I live with, whether even back in the day, like roommates and stuff, I'd be like, you got to keep pathways clear. Like you can't leave stuff on the floor in hallways or on stairs or places where we have to walk, or you got to walk from this room to the bathroom. Like, there's a pathway you're going to take walking. Don't put anything in that pathway because I'm going to trip on it and I'm going to fall and I'm going to break stuff. And, you know, I would have these conversations with her all the time, and she'd like hang stuff on the wall right in like a doorway. So now the doorway is this wide, but now it's this wide because there's a thing hanging in it. And now I've got to walk, and I would just bump into the thing all the time. And I'd be like, or even putting stuff on the stairs. Like, she would set things, go like things that had to go out to the shed or had to go out to the garbage, and would go outside and just set them on the stairs on the porch. And I'd go, can you not set things on the stairs? Because it's, that's actually dangerous for me, because I'm more likely to trip on them. And I would like many times I would trip on shit. And I'd ask again and again and again and again, like, and I remember at one point I said to her, like, if you lived with a blind person, would you put things in their pathway? If they had sort of established pathways of movement in the home, would you put things in their path if they were blind? And she goes, well, no, I wouldn't. And I go, so I want you to treat me like I'm blind, because I'm not, it's not that I can't see, it's that my brain doesn't process where I am in space. So I have similar issues. Mm-hmm. Don't move the furniture around. It's like, this is a funny example. Like, at my work, I work in a bar, right? So there's like this area behind the bar where there's a blue box that sits on the ground for recycling. And there's another area closer to the kitchen where a similar blue box sits for recycling. The blue boxes are slightly different size. One of them is about a half an inch bigger than the other. But I am so trained in my space in work that if the two blue boxes are switched in position, then I start clipping the one with my shin constantly when I walk by it, because it's a half inch out in space and my brain can't adjust for that difference. So I'll go into work, like, someone will take both blue boxes out to the dumpster bins, right? And then bring them both back, but put them in the different space. I have to switch where those are so that I don't constantly trip on one, because, like I said, it's a half inch out into the space that I'm not used to. And my body, it's like I train myself on the space, and it's like I can't quickly adjust to like little differences. And it sounds fucking crazy saying that out loud. Anyone who's neurotypical would be like, well, what's your deal? You can't just see where the thing is. Like, don't trip on it. It's like, but it's not that. It's like I've literally like created like a neural pathway in my brain of how to navigate this particular corner thousands of times. And if it's something changes slightly in it, I just will spend the entire night banging my shin into that little recycling bin. Like, it's stupid.
I have so many things to say to that. To add to that, with the driving, so many autistics, they don't know their spatial awareness or their spatial aroundness.
Yes.
They're how they relate to the space around them. And that's one of the other trepidations about driving.
Yes.
Keeping in my space and navigating my space in relationship to others, you know, giving and allowing the proper amount in front and back and to either side.
Yeah.
And that anxiety is just overwhelming for so many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with my son, I noticed that a lot in him. He's like bumping into things and everything, you know, and like a neurotypical would say, you know, he's clumsy and he's awkward. It's just, no, he has like dyspraxia. He just doesn't know where his body is in relationship to time and space all the time. And my spouse, she struggles with that as well. She recently, not too long ago, broke her leg. and she's having to use a wheelchair to get around and a walker and such.
Yeah.
And the house, and just having to figure out how to maneuver those things in the house. Cause our house is more long than it is wide.
Okay.
And it doesn't really, it's not really ADA conducive. It's not really compliant with, if there was like a disability analysis, you know, seeing if the building was compliant with disability code, and right now it wouldn't be. It's an older home, but anyway, we've had to like move stuff around and move shit out of the way. And she spends a lot of time out on our covered back porch, just not only because the weather's nice and such, and it's just, she can be in her own element out there. Just part of it, I think, is just to keep from banging into shit. And it's, you know, those are some of the things. And and we were talking about like your personal space before. And my job as a driver license examiner, I sit in the passenger seat.
Yeah.
And I evaluate the driver in the driver's seat. You know, the only time I ever invade their personal space is for safety.
Yeah. To not die.
Yeah. Because I am trained to reach over and grab the wheel if necessary. Yeah. To steer the car out of the way. I'm trained, if the e-brake is in the middle, I'm trained to pull the e-brake.
Yeah.
And otherwise I don't interfere with their personal space.
Yeah.
I just give them directions, observe how they do it, and evaluate the test, and give the results when we get back. And I'm so grateful that I've been training how to, I don't like to have my personal space invaded. I don't know anybody who really does.
Yeah.
That's the only time that out on the road I invade anybody's personal space.
Yeah.
Is for safety and
to not die.
Yeah. Yeah. not get to a catastrophic accident.
Yeah.
And then have to explain that to management. It's like,
yeah.
Well, what did you do to prevent it? Well, yeah, it's like, well, I grabbed the wheel, I pulled the brake, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't want an accident, because I don't want all that paperwork. They don't want all that paperwork.
No. Oh man, this is awesome. I just suddenly looked at the clock and realized we've been going 2 hours. This, it feels not that long to me, but
me neither.
Are you guys are you guys okay if we call it here and maybe do this again?
I'm cool. Yeah.
Was there anything that we missed that you were hoping to talk about today, or?
I didn't really have an agenda. I just wanted to reach out and share a little bit about myself.
Yeah.
With the world, and put it out to the ether. And I just wanted to,
I love
this, listening to the show. This felt like a safe platform and a safe environment. And listening to all the other guests, I was like, you know, the people you've had on them before have been awesome. Yeah. I have rocked. And each time I listen to other guests, I'm like, these people are living their authentic selves. These people know their shit, and they embrace who they are. And I'm like, I embrace who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reach out, see what they have to say, see if they want to talk with me.
Yeah. This was just like, I love these conversations sometimes because, well, I should all the time, but I loved today. I just feel like it was like, just like, it's Saturday morning. Let's just have coffee and talk about whatever. And a lot of the time the episodes have followed a bit of a similar arc each time, but this time today, I feel like we just kind of went in a bunch of different directions,
but I really enjoyed it. I just enjoyed sort of feeling comfortable and feeling safe and just feeling like we're just chatting and loving to kind of just get to know you and you're about your life and who you are and how you do things. And I feel like I learned a lot of, like, I appreciate like your opinions and your attitude and your just kind of general being in a way that I'm really feel good about.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I feel the same, and I want more authentic conversations like this all throughout, whether it's through Zoom, you know, right now because of the pandemic, or when we get back to quote unquote normal and being able to interact and intersect with people again. You know, I just want this authenticity. I want people to know that and accept that autistics are, we're just human beings like everybody else.
Yeah.
We're not broken. We're not, we just think differently. We just have.
Yeah.
And when neurotypical people start seeing that they can benefit from the heightened awareness that autistic people possess and work in harmony, then it's going to be fucking off the charts.
Yeah. It's not the bad thing that you make it out to be. It's only a quote unquote bad thing, 'cause you choose to label it as a bad thing.
Yeah.
You choose not to open up your worldview and open up your, not necessarily your minds, but open up your hearts and your spirits.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of the ignorance is because people are willfully ignorant. They don't want to change. They don't want to adapt. They don't want to, anything that doesn't fit in their little circle or their worldview, they reject. And I'm like, well, you're missing out on getting to know a lot of awesome, amazing, wonderful, terrific people that can only make your experience bigger, better, and brighter.
Absolutely.
And whatever part I can do to instigate that and be a part of that change and part of that world, then so be it. No matter big or small, whatever I can do, I'm going to do. And that's that.
Well, thanks for showing up to be a part of our humble little podcast up here in Canada. Man, I really want to do this again with you. I
love it.
It's so fun. And
I love it too.
And everything you just said is exactly the mission for why we're doing this. Like, you know, Drew and I work on this show every week, and like, we don't make any money on this show. We actually, I was about to say we lose money on the show, but I don't consider it, I don't consider it a loss, but we spend money and we spend time to produce the show, to put it out. But I don't consider that losing money, because I get messages every week from people all around the world who say, thank you. And this is, you know, I'm listening to your show and it's speaking to me and it's articulating things I think are important for people to hear. And it's giving us a voice, and it's like, and you know, we're just doing this little small thing, but it is reaching people, and I think it's beautiful, and I'm so grateful to be able to do it and able to talk to people like you. It's awesome, man. And I think there's so many of us that are, you know, late diagnosed or figuring it out later and have to kind of work to undo all this internalized feeling of being not good enough and broken and all this stuff. And my hope is that like we can just kind of leave a few markings along the path for those coming behind us to help them avoid some of the negative sides that we've had to face and highlight some of the positive sides. So hopefully people can get to that positive, like authentic version of themselves sooner, you know, and also for the neurotypical world to like get to know us a bit, because we have neurotypical listeners to this podcast too, who write us letters and say, hey, like this is helping me understand what but you know what I mean? Like, this is helping me understand.
The letters are really aggressive.
They're really aggressive, but it's helping me understand life from an autistic experience in a way that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And I literally just got a note from somebody like a couple days ago, a neurotypical person who just started listening, and she's gone through like the first five episodes so far and sent me this letter and was like, or an email, and was just like, this show's really cool and I'm fascinated by it and I appreciate you guys doing it. And like, how better to learn about a topic than from the people living it? And so it's cool, man. It's awesome.
It is cool. And just reading the reviews on iTunes and everything, you know, they all seem to be more positive than anything. And at least the ones I'm choosing to read.
Oh, I don't even think I've ever read any reviews on iTunes.
I don't read them to make my decisions. I just seeing what are other people saying, or are they feeling the same thing I'm feeling, or am I just totally out in left field?
Yeah.
And they've all seemed to be positive and such. And I think you guys are awesome. I love talking with you. I think this is time very well spent, at least hopefully for you. It certainly was for me.
Yeah.
And I don't, going back to the money thing, I don't think you can put a price on time like this. And
no,
you shouldn't have to. And
no,
there's no reason to. Yeah. And that's what keeps it authentic and real.
Yeah, 100%.
Therapy. It's Saturday therapy. And Dave, we got to keep you on the radar because, you know, the long-term plan with this project is first we got to get our Ryan's bus road ready. And then we're going to take hopefully when the time is right and when it's safe, we will take the show on the road. And, when the world allows us to, maybe we can team up at one of those autism events that you were discussing earlier.
Yeah.
I'd love that.
I was just going to ask you about that conference. Two questions is, one, like, where was it located again? And then two, do you know if they have plans to do it again?
I think they have plans to do it again. I don't know for sure. I mean, I'm not in the loop, but I know that if all the stars align, they want to do it again.
Yeah.
And it was located in San Diego.
Oh, it's in San Diego. Yeah.
And it's called Love and Autism.
Yeah.
There's clips on YouTube from some of the past conferences and some of the past speakers.
Yeah.
And there's they have a website, loveandautism.com.
Yeah.
And they just talk about how they want to just change the narrative around autism.
Because that's something that's super cool. And that's something that, like, if they do that, once the world opens up again, assuming it ever does.
And I'm not paid or endorsed by them to say any of this. This is all personal positive experiences that I've had with that conference and my participation in it.
We would, I think that's the kind of thing I would love to go to. Like, if they do it again, like I would, you know, Drew and I, like, we could just be like, yo, let's hop on a plane. Let's go check it out. Like, let's print up some flyers for the podcast and just go meet people and listen to lectures and conversations. And just, you know, it's such a great community. Everyone I've met so far in this autism community, I mean, it's just, well, it's like coming home, right? It's pretty cool.
It is. That's a great, great analogy. It's a great vision.
Like, all the frustrations that I have in all of my neurotypical relationships, like, I know I can leave them at the door when I come here Saturday morning. And I know that I can actually, like, improve those relationships having had these kinds of conversations with like-minded people.
Yeah.
I think you should always go into any relationship leaving it better than how you came in with it.
Yeah.
And what you give is into it outweighs what you receive from it.
Yeah.
Because what you give to it enhances what you receive.
100%. And that's a perfect quote to end on. We're gonna put that quote on an Instagram post if you're okay with it.
I'm cool with that. Yeah, I have my handle on Instagram. Can I share that?
Yeah, sure.
Reach out. My handle on Instagram is driving while autistic. Hashtag nice. Driving while autistic.
That's wow. Your hashtag too. Okay.
That's brilliant.
So we'll Dave, we're gonna have usually I try to get the show up right away on Saturdays when we do it. I got a couple things I gotta deal with today, so it might be tomorrow, but I should have the show up on podcast apps, let's say within 48 hours. So we'll email you when that's up so you can check it out and share it if you want. And then I'm working on getting them up on YouTube soon, but that might be another little while. So if you're okay with us putting up the video as well on YouTube, that would be awesome. If you're not, that's fine too.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. So, and then, yeah. And same thing when we get the new show, when we get the episode up, we'll post it on Instagram and I'll make sure to tag you in that too. So.
Sounds great.
Awesome.
Look forward to it.
Yeah. Thanks so much, man. This has been great. I love it. And I really hope that we get to do it again.
Me too.
Right. Have a great Saturday, Dave. Right. Thanks for waking up early. Thanks for getting up.
Thanks for getting up early. Thanks for taking the time.
I feel totally jazzed and energized. So
nice.
Good to go. All right, Dr. be well.
Dre. Dr. Drew.
Skittles.
be well.
Bye, you too, man. Thank you.
See you, Dave.
Sup, boy.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.